It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new study finds that ultra-processed foods can cause significant weight gain. We'll talk about the research when we check out some of the most intriguing stories in the world of science. First, the college admission test, known as the SAT, will implement a measurement of adversity when compiling scores for students who take the exam. For years, the test itself has been criticized for skewing in favor of higher-income students who typically have greater access to tutors or prep materials, while middle- to lower-income students are left behind. The new metrics will include where the student lives and the quality of the high school they attend. Our next guest has been covering the change and is here to talk about the role of college admission tests in today's higher education world. Scott Jasek is an editor for Inside Higher Ed. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here.
Well, tell us what this change is and how it would work. I've seen a lot of, misinformation about what this is.
Yes. So it would be an additional score that will appear reported to the college for every student who takes the SAT. So they would get whatever their score is on the actual test, and then an adversity score on a scale of up to 100. The student won't know his or her adversity score, but the college will, in theory, so they have more context to evaluate, you know, a student who went to a low-income high school in a dangerous neighborhood versus a student who went to high school in a wealthy suburb.
And one thing that I've seen that seems to get it wrong, this will not say, okay, we're going to take that adversity score and then change your SAT score. The SAT score stays the same.
No, the SAT score, you're right. The SAT score stays exactly the same, and it's up to the college to decide whether they're going to use this at all. There's no requirement that they do so. In fact, many colleges today would say that they already factor in such things, although without a score, because they're aware that there are very different opportunities available based on socioeconomics. Across all income levels, the wealthier you are, on average, the better you will do on the SAT.
What goes into this measurement of adversity? What factors does the College Board plan to use here?
So they are mostly about the high school and the neighborhood. Does the high school send on a lot of students to college? Does the high school offer a lot of AP courses, AP also run by the College Board? What is the crime situation in the neighborhood? Are families stable in the neighborhood? Is there a lot of moving around? Are people homeless? But what's important is this is all information about either the high school or the neighborhood. It's not about the specific student. So while most high schools do serve in our society, either wealthy or non-wealthy, if you were the poor kid in a wealthy high school, you might not get a high adversity score. And if you were the wealthy kid in a poor high school, you might get a high adversity score.
Talking to Scott Jasek from Inside Higher Ed, looking at a change that the College Board is bringing to the SAT, including, in effect, an adversity index that will go along with test scores for students if colleges want to look at them. Scott, what do we know about why the College Board wants to make this change, and presumably why colleges and universities would want them to?
So the College Board, one, they're losing some colleges, are dropping the SAT and the ACT as a requirement. Many colleges are worried about this issue of whether it unfairly privileges wealthier applicants. And while the adversity index will not consider race or ethnicity, the reality is a disproportionate number of low-income students in America are Black and Latino. So there is concern that if the Supreme Court bars colleges from considering race and ethnicity in admissions, which could happen in a few years, that it would be they might not want to use the SAT if they feared that would give them entering classes without very many Black and Latino students.
Have colleges or universities said how they want to use this so far?
Not yet, but the reality is lots of colleges say they're already doing this. You know, these days, any college admissions officer has a computer in which they can quickly compare a student based on high school or neighborhood or background. So it's not actually a new concept. The College Board is putting this together in a sort of neat way, I guess. But I would be hard-pressed to find colleges with competitive admissions that don't say they do a form of this already.
Now, when I took the SAT, and it's been a few days, I'm not going to lie, but I feel like the idea was this is an objective measure of your college readiness, regardless of who you are and where you come from. Does anybody believe that anymore?
Well, I mean, in theory, the College Board does, but here's the reality is there are a lot of very talented Black and Latino students who go to lousy high schools. The reality is you do better on the SAT if you take a rigorous college preparatory curriculum. College Board will tell you that. ACT will tell you that. Well, who's more likely to do that? Students who go to suburban high schools or private high schools. Who's more likely to do that? The wealthy. Our society just has, you mentioned the advantage of tutors, but I would say it's the advantage of high schools is where I would start, that some high schools offer much more rigorous training in the courses that would help somebody do well on the SAT. It is not equal in American society.
And we're hearing about these changes now, but I understand the College Board has been testing these for a while now. Is that right?
Yes, for several years they've been testing it. They have been doing it with 50 colleges. They're going to go up to 150 next year before offering it to all colleges.
And this news about this broke recently after all the big college admissions scandals that came out of well-to-do families kind of buying their way, in effect, into colleges. Those aren't necessarily connected, though, are they?
They're not directly connected. This is a project that the College Board was at work on well before. But the scandal only affects a small number of students, the scandal has drawn attention to the many advantages that the wealthy have. The scandal is about actions that are elite, that if they happened, and many of them clearly have, were illegal. It's not illegal if you have the means to do so to send your kid to a wealthy private school. It's not illegal to hire a tutor. It's not illegal to have your kid take the SAT 8 times. There are lots of advantages of the wealthy, and I think the scandal has just put those advantages front of mind to many more people, even if directly that's not what this is about.
What kind of reactions have you been hearing so far, Scott, in the higher education world, the sort of people who presumably are the target audience for these changes?
So some are happy. Many admissions officials just say, you know, I welcome any and all contacts. But many advocates for low-income students and minority students are being quite critical. They note that that it doesn't include race and say that race matters. There's also a lot of attention on the fact that students won't know what their adversity score is. And there are also many who say that families will find ways to game the system. And I guess what we have seen in the scandal is that families will do whatever it takes, or some will do whatever it takes, even breaking the law, to give their kid a leg up.
And you wrote in your piece about this that there's been reaction from opponents of affirmative action who are worried that this could be, in effect, a backdoor to some sort of race-based preferences. What's the argument there?
Right. Well, they say that colleges will see, oh, high adversity index. Okay, we'll let that student in with low SAT scores and low grades. Now, the reality is because the adversity index isn't directly about race, that isn't 100% true, but many of those who would get a high adversity score are Black and Latino. So they're saying it's a backdoor way to do that. Then there are a lot of fans of affirmative action who believe it's necessary, who want to know why it's wrong to say, hey, we want to consider race.
We're talking to Scott Jasek right now, editor for Inside Higher Ed. He's been covering the College Board's new changes to the SAT, including this measurement of adversity based on the zip code and high school of the student in large part. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the new changes to the SAT being rolled out, some schools at a time, and the idea of measuring the adversity a student might have encountered that might give some context to that number they come out of the test with? What role do you think standardized tests should play in college admissions? Do you think there should be changes in general to how people get selected at institutions of higher education in general? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Farad. Right now, we continue our conversation about the latest changes to the college admissions exam, the SAT. The company that administers that test has included a new, or will include a new, adversity index, which takes into account where the test taker lives and the quality of their high school. Our guest is Scott Jasek, editor for Inside Higher Ed, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea? Do you think it could be helpful to give a fuller picture for college admissions on what a student went through to get that 1,000 or 1,200 or whatever kind of numbers they're getting on the SAT? Should tests like the SAT, the ACT play a big role in who gets into college? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Zach is with us in Green Bay. Zach, hi.
Hi, how you doing, Rob?
Good. What did you want to ask about, Zach?
I have two sisters that are currently in high school, and this is all the time for the SAT prep and ACTs. But they're both homeschooled right now, and they've moved around a lot. Will this affect them at all, or how are the homeschool scores calculated?
Interesting, Zach. Thanks for bringing that up. Do we know, Scott, how we would measure high school adversity for a homeschooler?
I don't think they could do the high school part of it. They could do the, again, part of it is on the neighborhood. So part of it they could. Generally, I would say test scores tend to be more important for homeschoolers than others. So I would definitely encourage your sisters to work hard on it, because some colleges don't have full trust in homeschool grades, and that may or may not be fair, but that's just a reality. They tend to be more likely to pay attention to test scores with homeschooled applicants than others.
Zach, thanks a lot for bringing that up. We'll go to Allison now in Waukesha. Allison, hello.
Hi. I just had two thoughts about this whole thing. The first one was, are applicants, would they have the ability to opt out of having that information, you know, put with their scores? You know, maybe they don't want anybody to know what their high school situation was, or, you know, where they lived or whatever. And then my second thought was, is there any possibility that that could adversely affect their chances of getting into a college? You know, say, you know, admissions people look at somebody coming from a low-income area and decide that they don't want that type of clientele on their campus.
Interesting. So could it be used to discriminate against people from those poor schools, Scott?
Well, I guess it could be. I mean, you have to assume, if you believe in this, good intent on the part of admissions officers. But I would note right now you can't apply to most colleges without saying the high school you went to. And if it's a public high school, you are also probably identifying your neighborhood. In general, having gone to a poor, low-income high school helps a student, because it does explain why, you know, the student in the wealthy suburban high school who has 10 AP courses and went to Baja, California to do environmental work in the summer, well, that student had a lot of advantages that maybe another did not. So in general, I think it is helpful to students for colleges to know what their actual conditions were.
Thanks for the call, Allison. So yeah, that's the core of the idea, Scott. If you, Scott, and I, Rob, have the same scores, but I went to a high school with more advantages, maybe had more access to AP classes and things like that, that same score might have a different meaning then to the college. It meant you worked harder, were sharper to begin with.
Right. And again, think of like the AP courses as an example. There are high schools with tons of options, with tons of foreign languages, with tons of lab sciences, and then there are other high schools that don't have very many. So the reality is the same, say, math SAT score or a biology AP score does not mean the same thing.
I want to go to our commenters on Facebook now. Libby wrote, get rid of the testing industry. The hardship comes in part because so much expense is involved in prep courses and tutoring and the luxury of taking the test repeatedly. Wealthy kids in better schools have so many advantages for which no adversity index can compensate. Testing keeps poor kids down. Is that argument out there that Libby is making, Scott?
That argument is definitely out there, and that may be part of why the College Board did this. The University of Chicago, for instance, this year went test optional. Now, the reality is, when you talk about the spending on test prep, that is not equal across all groups. If you're a real poor kid, you might be fortunate enough to find some free test prep. But when you talk about the amount of money being spent on test prep, and it is obscene at some levels, it is primarily the wealthier students.
We're talking to Scott Jasek, editor for Inside Higher Ed, looking at college admissions, this new change from the SAT saying they're going to include what's being called an adversity index, looking at a neighborhood and a school a student is from and comparing it to the advantages or disadvantages from one place to another, giving colleges that background behind the number. You can still join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Scott, I've seen the argument that if you get rid of tests, then that makes grades more important. So that's where the pressure goes to. The pressure is going to be somewhere.
Right. And it is also true that an A in one high school is not the same as an A in another high school. And grade inflation is real. A lot of the research shows, though, that grade inflation is the worst at colleges with wealthier students who clearly have expectations that they will earn A's. So there are ways, you know, a high school transcript can tell you what percentage of students got A's, what percentage went on to college, and has information about the courses and their rigor. So a good college admissions officer isn't just looking at the GPA, but is looking at the GPA and what it actually represents.
Yeah, what all is in a toolkit usually for the college admissions officer? Obviously, we've got the test scores, if it's a school that uses that, the grades, some information about the high school, admissions essays, things like that. Do those really play a role?
So the top factor, according to all surveys, is grades and college preparatory courses, followed by and adding in tests. Then you have essays, you have extracurricular activities, you have teacher recommendations. All of those are important, but play less of a role typically than grades and college preparatory courses and test scores. And then you have lots of other advantages. So, for instance, a lot of colleges want athletes. And so the reality is the star football player may get in over somebody with better grades and test scores who is not a star football player. So the idea that it's a pure formula, which a lot of people seem to still believe, is not true.
Let's bring on another caller now. Mike is with us in Paola. Mike, hi. Mike, are you there?
Yeah.
There we go.
Yeah,
sorry, we had trouble ringing you up. Mike, hi.
Hi. My question is, you know, why don't we just do away with the test preparation industry? I mean, it seems that the idea of having the test questions or the test formats really well known allows for kids and families that have the resources so that they can invest in all this stuff and these test preparation courses. And I'd love to hear what does obscene mean to your guest? In comparison to somebody who not only are they going to a school maybe that doesn't have any of that, but on top of that, you know, they got to work a job because that, you know, when they're a junior or senior in high school, their family needs that income.
Mike, thanks for the call. Scott, could we get rid of the test prep industry?
So I think it would be very hard to ban it. I mean, these are private businesses that aren't part of schools. And just as, say, a wealthy individual probably can get tax help that you and I couldn't, that's legal. So I don't see a legal means to make it illegal to offer these services. That's sort of free enterprise.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Richard now in Lakewood. Richard, hi.
Hi. Hey, my question is this. If you're a high school grad who goes into the service, comes out as a vet and applies to college, how does this system affect your applying and getting in?
Interesting, Richard. Thanks for bringing that up. And that could apply to veterans or other so-called non-traditional students. Scott, are they in a different circle here?
Right. So this is assuming that students are going straight from high school to college. There's a whole bunch of separate issues for veterans, who are a very important group going into higher ed. Generally, veterans are great students and have learned a lot in military service. And the military is a great institution at teaching people how to learn because people are constantly trained for new duties. So I don't see this helping them as much. But a lot of colleges are stepping up their recruitment of veterans because they are outstanding students.
Thanks a lot for the call, Richard. That brings up a point. Are we trying to do our admission systems to bring in different groups of people to serve the nation, or are we trying to figure out who's going to be successful in college based on what they've already done? That's two different approaches, it seems like.
Well, I'm not sure it's an either or. I mean, I think both come into play. But many people would say, if we look at our society, if only kids from wealthy families get ahead and go to college, our society will not be well served. They are not the majority of the population, and every community needs its talent nurtured. In a state like Wisconsin, that doesn't just mean low-income students in urban areas of Milwaukee. It also means rural students. Many rural students may also have high adversity scores if their high schools don't offer the services that one would get at a wealthier institution. So many educators would say what our society needs is, in fact, a broad cross-section of students going to college.
We'll leave it there. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Great to be here. Have a good day, everybody.
We've been talking to Scott Jasek. He's an editor for Inside Higher Ed. He joins today to talk about a new adversity index the company behind the SAT will include in its scoring in the future. That'll include information about the high school a student attended, the neighborhood they live in, and the learning conditions and safety conditions in that area. And then colleges can use that to help evaluate the meaning of that SAT score. Still time for you to share your thoughts online. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page and you can join the conversation there, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up after the news, from modern food and how it affects us to ancient beer and what happened to it, we'll check out some of the most intriguing stories from the world of science. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, state Republicans called for stricter laws against abortion and made plans for 2020, while U.S. Senator Ron Johnson mulls his political future. We'll recap this weekend's state GOP convention in Oshkosh and where the party goes from here. First, it's time for our monthly check-in on some of the latest news from the world of science. A new study stacks up processed foods against whole foods and finds out what they mean for weight gain. We'll learn more about the study and how it might impact the way we eat in the future. Plus, this summer marks the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, and we'll check out some really, really old beer. Anna Groves is an assistant editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Anna, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with this study. This got some attention here, saying maybe not all calories are created equal. This study looked at processed foods versus whole foods. People have talked about that a long time. How did they try to tackle that issue?
Right. So a lot of studies over the past couple of decades have been looking at these processed foods and doing sort of long-term studies that correlate some of these foods with different health problems. But this new study really wanted to know if processing the foods itself had any health effects. So there's all these things that are sort of tangled up with processed foods. Like, they usually have more fat, more salt, more sugar. They're usually pretty low in things like protein and fiber, things that are good for you. So this study really tried to control all of these other factors that sort of get in the way of figuring out whether the processing itself matters. So they had to do this crazy study where they gave the participants in the study very specific meals for 2 weeks straight, switched them over from a whole food diet to an ultra-processed diet, or vice versa, And they just like controlled every single thing down to the amount of carbs that was in every meal, the amount of proteins, the amount of sugars, the amount of salts. And the only thing different was how processed the meals were.
And what I love about this study, when I think about nutritional studies, I always wonder, well, how do you know what they eat when they're not there in front of you? Well, they solved that by saying, hey, if you want to be in the study, you have to go on lockdown for a month, right?
Right. Right. Yeah. Apparently this is a huge problem with diet studies is because most of them just sort of ask people like, hey, what'd you eat?
Oh, nothing but kale, man.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to remember. Maybe some people aren't honest. Maybe some people sign up to do a study, but then they're sort of cheating on the side. But yeah, these people were literally on lockdown at the National Institute of Health for a month.
Okay, so what do we learn here? We've got, you're matching up, some people got the processed stuff, some people got the whole foods, but the nutritional kind of content looks the same. What ends up happening?
So after 2 weeks of eating the super processed foods, everybody gained an average of 2.5 pounds in just 2 weeks. And when they switched to the other diet, the whole food diet, everybody on average lost 2.5 pounds. And this is regardless of what weight they started at.
Interesting. So maybe there's something about how foods are processed that makes them, I don't know, either makes us eat more of them or makes them worse for us?
Yeah, one researcher I talked to described it, this was actually kind of gross, but he described it as, it's as if the food is already digested. Like there's something about a whole food as it occurs in nature that is different from if you broke down that food into all of its component parts and then tried to put it all back together.
Now, you are a biologist by training. Looking at this study, does this change the way you would eat or the way you suggest other people would eat?
Oh, my gosh. I was so surprised at how normal the processed food diet seemed to be.
Yeah, what kind of stuff?
The researchers published their menus that they used in the study, and I was expecting it to be total junk food, but it was just like a lunch meat sandwich, maybe some chips, a bagel and cream cheese. It was things I eat all the time. So,
okay, so
I'm going to eat a little healthier now, I think.
Okay, so more whole foods. And by whole foods, we should say, what kind of things are we talking about?
Oh, like things from the produce section, fruits and vegetables that are fresh, things like meats that are not processed, like just steaks, chicken breasts, things that are one ingredient and are in their original form.
Talking to Anna Gross from Discover Magazine, looking at some of the most intriguing stories in the world of science. Now, in the latest edition of Discover, you mark the 50-year anniversary this summer, I guess, of the Apollo mission, of the moon landing. This has changed science a lot over the years. You wrote an interesting piece about the role of geologists. I don't really think about that, the role of geologists in training for the moon landing.
Yeah, so the moon landing was this really cool opportunity for researchers on Earth to actually study the moon's surface in person, but the astronauts were mostly like pilots, like they didn't know anything about geology, but they went through this really extensive geology training before they went on their Apollo missions. So researchers who are based out of Arizona at the U.S. Geological Survey were actually very involved in training for the Apollo missions.
And one of the tricky things was how to pick up a rock while you're wearing a spacesuit.
Yes. Oh, yes. They practiced that a lot. They had to practice all of their gear. I mean, everything was something that nobody had ever done before, and they just went through the motions over and over again to make sure everything would go off without a hitch.
And speaking of geology, Game of Thrones, the TV show, came to a conclusion last night. One mineral in it, a dragonglass, or as we people on Earth call it, obsidian, was a big part of the show. What do we know about what obsidian tells us about human prehistory?
Well, obsidian is a really cool thing to find at an archaeological site because the chemical compositions of this material can be traced back to their specific sources. So obsidian is actually, it really is a type of glass, and it's made from cooling lava. I like to think that that's why dragons got involved with Game of Thrones. But scientists can trace it back to their source. So if you find like an obsidian arrowhead or something like that, and you can source it to its original site, you can see where the people that had that obsidian arrowhead had traveled, or maybe you might learn that they had traded with another ancient group to get that arrowhead.
And finally, you wrote, Anna, about brewing. Now, we here in Wisconsin think we have some pretty old breweries, and we do, but you wrote about some archaeological research that takes New World Brewing back, another 1,000 years or so. Tell us about the ancient brewery among the Huari in Peru.
Yeah, so some archaeologists have found this 1,000-year-old brewery that's pre-Incan. The Huari civilization was before the Incas. And they made this beer called a chicha, and they made it out of probably corn and definitely Peruvian pepper berries, which wasn't something I knew you could make a beer out of.
Me neither. what do we know about how they made it?
Yeah, so this really cool study came out where the archaeologists were able to look at residues that were on these ancient clay vessels, like the pots and kegs, modern-day equivalent of kegs. And they could use that residue to look at the chemical composition of the ancient beer, and they were able to figure out what the recipe actually was and recreate it.
And yeah, so they've actually made the pottery and then the brew itself, right?
Yes. They went through, this must have been a huge effort. They first made replica pottery, just like you said. They got an indigenous potter down in Chile who could make replica vessels. Some of them are on display at the Field Museum in Chicago. Then they actually brewed replica chicha down in Peru using the original ingredients that they've sourced locally. And then in Chicago, they teamed up with an actual brewery, Off Color Brewing in Chicago, to make a beer that tastes like the ancient chicha did that they had made in Peru.
That's pretty cool. But yeah. It was a wild ending for this archaeological brewery, right? After producing beer for, or whatever we want to call it, brew for decades and decades, how they shut it down.
Yeah, so the researchers said that the evidence at the site shows that this brewery had been shut down in like a big extravagant party, that it was burned to the ground, but intentionally. And the reason why they think that is because on top of the ashes are a bunch of smashed drinking vessels that are from all around. So it seems like not just Huari people, but people from like neighboring civilizations came to this festival. They burned down the brewery, smashed their mugs, covered it with soil, and like put some ceremonial jewelry on top. So it looks like it was intentionally burned to the ground in one final bash after hundreds of years of running.
They knew how to party. Anna, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Anna Groves, assistant editor at Discover Magazine. She joined us for a monthly check-in on some of the latest science news. You can find her pieces on that new food study and the 500-year-old brewery in Peru. Find that at WPR.org. Coming up, U.S. Senator Ron Johnson's term ends in 2022. Could he seek a third term or maybe even run for governor? We'll look at that and other big questions at this weekend's state Republican convention that's coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, federal authorities recently raided a Milwaukee pain treatment clinic after allegations that it was overprescribing opioid painkillers. We'll learn more about the facility and other clinics in the area that have been investigated. First, as GOP-controlled states pass tough laws against abortion, the issue was on the minds of Wisconsin Republicans at their annual convention in Oshkosh this weekend. The event came shortly after the assembly passed four bills that would restrict abortion in the state, but not everyone in attendance thought Republicans were doing enough. Republicans also focused on next year's elections, which include races for state Supreme Court justice, the legislature, and president. There were also questions about the political future of U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. Sean Johnson is Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol Bureau Chief. He covered the convention this weekend. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
So Republicans lost the statewide races last fall. The candidate they backed for state Supreme Court justice, though, won last month. So split story. What was the mood like this weekend?
Yeah, I don't think you heard a lot of mourning exactly at this convention. There was talk about what they need to do headed toward 2020 when it comes to the statewide races. in kind of a recognition that they need to rebuild the party's grassroots is the refrain you heard over and over again at this convention. But there was a lot of celebration of the April election, which is officially nonpartisan, as we always say, but where the conservative candidate won in a very close race and very explicitly thanked the conservative grassroots of the Republican Party for delivering that victory.
I want to give a listen to Brian Hagedorn, the Supreme Court Justice-elect, not yet sworn in, right? But soon will be. He, as you mentioned, spoke at the convention. Here's some of what he had to say.
Thank you. Thank you. When I got punched, you were the ones who punched back. When I got knocked down, you grabbed the baton and you kept running with it. You did. You did this. And I don't want you to let anybody else tell you anything else. You did this. You saved the Supreme Court. You helped preserve the rule of law and the Constitution for this in the state of Wisconsin. And I was just happy to fight with you and alongside you. And again, I'm here to say thank you.
So Hagedorn and basically every state Supreme Court candidate in the state run saying they are not affiliated with a party. They're not a tool of a party. Here's the newest Supreme Court justice telling a party, thanks, you got me here.
Yeah.
It's a little unusual.
It is a little unusual. So I was trying to think. I mean, a couple of years ago, you had a couple of the liberal candidates who were running for Supreme Court address the Democratic State Convention. And we thought that was unusual. But I don't think I've ever seen somebody who's been elected, who is definitely going to the court, come to a party in the way that Brian Hagedorn did here and say, thanks, Republicans, you got me elected. And because that's what he said. He also said that, look, there are going to be times when I issue rulings from the court that you may not agree with. But it's because I'm doing my job the way that I said I would. But here he was pretty explicitly saying it was the Republican grassroots that were the difference in his race, which was decided by fewer than 6,000 votes.
And there's another Supreme Court election next year. Dan Kelly, incumbent justice, another conservative, as people rate these things in Wisconsin, up for re-election. This is on the same day as a Democratic primary for president. We probably won't still have 22 candidates on that ballot. Who knows? But this could be a big turnout motivator for Democratic voters.
It could. I mean, it's always tough to say what a race is going to look like a year away because Wisconsin's primary is kind of late in the process as far as the Democratic primary nominating process. But with that many candidates, there's a plausible argument to say that Wisconsin will still be relevant, and that could get Democrats to the polls while they're there. They would cast a vote for Supreme Court.
Now, U.S. Senator Ron Johnson spoke at the convention. He said the party needs what he called a grassroots juggernaut. You mentioned that grassroots for the 2020 elections. Did he or others talk much about President Trump and the role he would play in those elections?
They talked a lot about President Trump. I would say always in a flattering light, too. And just to give some context here, I mean, it was 2016 at the state party convention when I covered it, and many Republicans would not even mention the president's name at the time. He was candidate Trump, but there was still definitely some warming up to do among Wisconsin Republicans just 3 years ago. In 2019, it's a very pro-Trump convention. People are talking about how he's getting the attention of voters in, you know, throughout Wisconsin and how he packed a recent rally in Green Bay, for example. So the vibe at this event, which I think is aptly described as the base of the base of the Republican Party, was very much pro-Trump.
All right. So you got Senator Ron Johnson. He has said in the past he wouldn't run for a third term. Now he's saying maybe it sounds like. I want to give a listen to some of his address to the convention.
A lot will depend on 2020. If we're not able to bring back the House and the Senate looks like, you know, that is the firewall, I would have to take that into consideration. But, you know, when I said second and final, that certainly was my intention. It's my preference. I can guarantee it's my wife's preference.
I think that's actually him talking to reporters.
Right.
But can you talk about what he said about maybe running for office again and maybe what you heard from other people at the Republican convention?
So it's recently come out that he is not closing the door on a Senate run and that he's also considering running for governor. In fact, there's been some reporting that suggests that's where he's leaning. In that answer, he sounded that was kind of what he volunteered. It sounds like if he's going to run for anything in that answer, that it would be for Senate to protect Wisconsin if it needed Wisconsin to be a firewall state, as he described it, to protect Republicans from losing the Senate. He did not close the door to running for governor either, but that's what he said when asked about kind of his plans in 2022.
Hey, how about former Governor Scott Walker? He has maintained a public profile. He tweets frequently. He does events. He's working with national groups. Was there talk about whether he would run again for governor, whether he might run for Senate against maybe Tammy Baldwin sometime? What are we hearing from and about him?
What we've heard from Governor Walker, former Governor Walker, is that we should be looking at that 2022 race, I think. If Johnson were to leave, then the Senate race is open, and then it's an opening for Governor Walker in a primary. If Johnson stays put and runs for Senate, then you could be potentially setting up another run for governor for Scott Walker in 2022. It's not something that he has ruled out. So Johnson was actually asked, could they both be on the ballot in 2022? And he said anything's possible.
Talking to WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, he was at the Republican State Convention over the weekend. A big issue there, abortion. And I want to go to the opening prayer for this. Can you set this one up for us, Sean?
Yeah, so this is before any of the scheduled political speakers are addressing the convention. But this is also coming after a week in which Republicans passed four bills in the assembly that would restrict abortion, including one that's been referred to as the Born Alive bill that would require doctors to care for a fetus if it survives an abortion attempt. So this is Reverend James Reif of St. John's Lutheran Congregation in Oshkosh who brought the issue up in his prayer.
Heavenly Father, you know that when Wisconsin Republicans had the majority under Governor Walker, they did nothing to safeguard the rights of the preborn. Now, however, when we have a Democrat governor, these same Republicans piously claim that they're against abortion, all the while knowing that any anti-abortion bill that they bring to the governor's desk will be vetoed. Dear Heavenly Father, forgive our Republican legislators for their hypocrisy.
Huh.
Strong words there in the prayer, which I mean, not everybody's always paying attention to necessarily at that time of morning, but he kind of delivered a shot there to GOP lawmakers. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss got up to speak, said he listened to the prayer and wanted to address it, said he was proud of the Republican record on abortion laws over the past 8 years.
Roe versus Wade outlawed state restrictions, right? It found a constitutional right. So number one, what has to happen is something has to happen at the federal level, and the states are the ones who are continuing to push the envelope to work through the courts to protect human life.
What else did you hear from Voss and others on the issue of abortion?
They talked about the bills that they just passed. This is something that the Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald has said that they're going to take up soon as well. Senator Johnson actually talked about abortion, too, said he was against a law like the one that was just passed in Alabama, which bans abortion, but that he did wish that Roe v. Wade had never been decided. He favored a state-by-state approach where you could have tougher laws in one state, more relaxed laws than another state if they chose. He said if you didn't like that, then you could move.
And what we sometimes see abortion as an issue that parties, Republicans on the one side, Democrats on the other, take to the base. They don't necessarily run on it in the general election. Did you see any tiptoeing along those lines?
It's not really, I guess, at this point in an odd year convention, right, in the summer, you're not thinking necessarily about what's going to be in the ads that are running in September, October, November of the even numbered years. So this was definitely a base oriented convention there from the opening prayer to, you know, when the leaders were speaking.
As we wrap up, Sean, anything else that came out of this weekend that you see as maybe a hint, a clue of things to come in the legislature or election season?
Yeah, I mean, there was a pretty aggressive back and forth there between Republican leaders, Voss and Fitzgerald, and Tony Evers' spokeswoman, Melissa Baldoff. Senator Fitzgerald got up there and said that budget negotiations aren't going well. There's no point person, he said, in the Evers administration when it comes to budget talks. Melissa Baldoff, the spokeswoman for the governor, said that the governor has communicated repeatedly to GOP leadership that they should work with his chief of staff, who is Maggie Gao. She said that directive wasn't confusing to them when the chief of staff was a man. Voss and Fitzgerald are clearly uncomfortable or simply unwilling to work with leadership team made up of women. Voss responded that he has women who are in high-level positions in his staff, but that was a direct accusation of sexism from the governor's office, and that's probably the way budget negotiations are going to go, or gives you an idea of them.
It's WPR's Sean Johnson. All good things come to an end. This week, we mark the end of a TV sensation. And a lot of fans might be justified in thinking it went out with a bit of a whimper. And we'll look back on May of 2019 as the month that brought us the end of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Wait, what show are you thinking about? Variety magazine reports that the producers of the American version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire say the show will not go back into production for another season. The show was a huge hit when it came out 20 years ago. That's back in 1999. After 3 years in primetime, it shifted over to syndication. It's aired almost 3,000 episodes in its run. There have been versions of the show along the way in about 90 different countries around the world. Now, I'll be honest with you. I didn't really know Who Wants to Be a Millionaire was still on. I think when it left primetime, it was off my radar. And I'll be even more honest, I was never a big fan. It was a huge phenomenon those first couple of years, but I'd always stack it up against Jeopardy, right? Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? You got about one question in every 5 minutes or so because there's all the drama and getting to know the person and phoning a friend. And Jeopardy, you know, you got like 30 questions in that 5 minute span. So I'm not going to mourn the end of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire or any of the other shows that just ended. This is Central Time.